Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
And good morning, everybody. Happy Thursday. Right, let's get right to it. The Supreme Court issuing some decisions at their end of their, essentially their 2026 and getting ready for their summer break. Supreme Court James Santel joining us in studio. Supreme Court James giving the president two major wins on immigration cases. Let's sort of review those and give us your take.
Absolutely. So we have this case involving the asylum policy. The court was reviewing a Department of Homeland Security policy that allowed the government to turn non-citizens away at the border without hearing their claims. That was that they had qualified for asylum. The question is, where do you adjudicate those? On which side of the border? Policy was an effect during the Obama administration, President Trump's first term, but reversed during the Biden administration. As a result of that, the question is whether or not the policy violates federal law. The Supreme Court today, in what appears to be, again, a 6-3 ruling, saying the Trump administration can, in fact, turn away migrants seeking asylum along the U.S.-Mexico border by physically preventing them from crossing into the United States as they seek protection from persecution. So it's a major victory for the administration, absolutely.
So what are they citing as far as that being a different, like what was the argument? Just rehash that for us.
Right. The statute says that any non-citizen who is physically present in the United States or arrives in the United States can apply for asylum. Migrants who announce their intention to seek protection are then referred for an interview to evaluate their claims. So the question was, what does arrival mean?
Okay.
It has to do with a definition, frankly, of the verb, the infinitive to arrive. And they've determined once again, 6-3, non-citizens have to fully cross the border to gain the right to apply. If you're not crossing, you do not have that right.
So functionally, it's basically up to Border Patrol then? If you show up and you're like, I want to apply for asylum, it is up, unless they come illegally and they
right,
cross over
right.
And then they're already here. It is up. This is leaving it up to Border Control to let them in to apply to this for asylum.
I think you've got it exactly right, Kristen. It's a very practical aspect here of how immigration law works. And you've got people making decisions right through at the border. Do you come in? Do I come in? And again, if you're physically here, then the rules change. What does arrival mean? And so we've got a definition of how those Border Patrol folks will behave in the future with respect to those people coming in petitioning for asylum.
Trump has talked about a physical wall for a long time. Mm-hmm. Is this not, as one of the commentators I was listening to this morning on my laptop said, this is now a legal wall preventing those people from coming into the United States illegally?
Absolutely. To the points both of you are making, well, if the determination is made that particular individuals cannot physically cross the border, then you've established that wall as a procedural matter. I think that's exactly right, yeah.
So is this, I always hesitate to ask this because it seems like it would be the end of the conversation. So is this ruling, which, and again, I saw a lot of commentators talking about this morning, essentially that they said that the Supreme Court doesn't have the jurisdiction on some of this stuff, which I don't get. Yeah. Is this the end of the road for that conversation, or could Congress at some point change the law, I guess?
Congress can plainly change the law, right? We're talking about a federal statute, and so all these kinds of things. If it is the legislature which would be deciding these things ultimately, right? You've got the Supreme Court interpreting language of the legislature. Legislature doesn't like this or does approve it and says, yes, indeed, we want to embrace this. Under the present circumstances, you don't have to make a change. If you want to make a change so that, yes, indeed, asylum applicants can make their applications on the other side of the border, Congress can do that tomorrow. Whether the president would sign that is another issue, of course. But, yes, legislative change could overturn what the Supreme Court has done this morning.
Can't they? But as it stands today, with no change, could asylum seekers apply for asylum in the United States while not in the United States?
That's effectively what the argument is, that they're making this request to come in. And again, under the Biden administration, previous administrations, the concept was you can make those applications and come in and pursue that. Here, the determination is that where you are geographically located, you may be prevented from doing that at all. And you stop the process from going forward.
So I just looked this up. So this year, the full year 2025, because we're still halfway through 2026, so the lowest number of actual people crossing the encounters, is the way they describe it, in over 50 years. Safe to say this ruling or decision by the U.S. Supreme Court will lower that number even more.
It should, right? I mean, again, I'm not saying that as a matter of advocacy for it one way or the other, but simply that as a practical matter, if you do not have the great numbers of people applying anymore for any kind of immigration status, including asylum, basically, once again, they're alleging that in their home countries, they're subject to persecution. There's some sort of fear. They may be killed. They may be attacked. And therefore, we've got to be here preserve our lives. If you don't have those applications going forward at the great numbers because of where you are geographically, presumably the chart, Steve, that you're looking at would continue to go down.
So I know you're not an international law expert, but are you familiar at all with how, either before or after this ruling, accepting, lenient, how did our asylum laws compare to other countries that people, like a Canada or Mexico or any of the Western European countries?
Right. My exposure actually goes back a long period of time. It's not, you're right. This is not my area generally, but again, I was in Iraq for 2 years. And we talked a lot about the nationals there providing support for our initiatives there, our government's initiatives, and then seeking asylum, other immigration processes. When you do those kinds of things, it is sort of the largesse of the nation, right? Whether it's the United States, Canada, any of the other nations to say, you know what? You have helped us overseas. We're going to extend to you this benefit, which has come to our nation. Maybe one day become a citizen if you like. And that's what all of this, at least today's opinion, has an impact upon. There are other processes by which people in those other countries assisting our initiatives there can get into our country. But this is certainly one of them saying, listen, if I remain in an Afghanistan or not Iraq too much anymore, they're now our allies, I will be persecuted. I've thrown my lot in with you Americans, and now I need to get protection basically from you. So it's a way of government saying, thank you for your support. We're going to reward you and indicate to you that, yes, indeed, your service was important.
Former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel joining us as our legal expert as we sort of weigh the decision-making of the U.S. Supreme Court. Still some big ones to come next week. Monday or Tuesday is what I'm being told. But there's another piece of this story about people coming to this country, foreign nationals, countries like Haiti and Syria,
right,
and what those protections are or are not. We'll discuss that with Jim Santel after this break on Point Taken on 6 Point WTMJ. Oh, well played, Producer Jazz, on this Thursday edition, another legal edition with former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel. I mentioned there was two cases that are generally considered by most of the commentators I was reading or watching this morning wins for the Trump administration when it comes to people coming to this country. And the other one has to do with foreign nationals from countries like Haiti and Syria. What's your read on the decision made by the U.S. Supreme Court this morning?
And once again, Steve, you got it just right. This is plainly a win for the administration. The Supreme Court saying that the administration can end humanitarian protections that have permitted literally hundreds of thousands of people, principally from Haiti and from Syria, migrants coming in from those countries to live and work legally in the United States. The concept here is a thing called TPS. Many of your listeners would recognize that as temporary protected status, and program created in 1990, providing temporary legal status to people whose home countries were deemed unsafe, again, because of war.
Real quick, just to jump in.
Yeah.
The Syrian number is small. It's 6,000.
It is.
The Haitian number is 350,000.
It is huge.
In the country.
Yep. Same concept, but absolutely. Different populations come in. 6-3, once again, right down ideological lines as we talk most frequently. As you say, 350,000 Haitians, 6,100 Syrians. And again, implications for TPS holders from about a dozen other countries as well. So, the Supreme Court, the case is Mullen versus Doe and Trump versus Miot, M-I-O-T, ability of government to quickly expel individuals who previously had protections will depend on whether they have already deportation orders pending. Lots of variations on this as well, but basically permitting the president to terminate this TPS program as to those nations.
So, is this basically a one-off basis as far as who gets deportation orders and who doesn't? Or is this going to be a mass, you know, obviously the famous they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats part town in Ohio. Like, is there just going to be a dissension onto that town to deport Haitians?
You know, that very well may be, depending upon how you implement this, right? You've basically said from the Supreme Court, yes, you may go ahead, Mr. President, and you can terminate this TPS program. what you do to enforce that. So the Supreme Court, as we often note, doesn't have a law enforcement entity itself. How is the executive branch, Kristen? I think that's the all-important question now. What do you do next with these huge numbers of people, again, no longer protected under the TPS program?
I am monitoring the White House Communications Office and social media just to see if the president has commented. I haven't seen an official comment yet. Interesting that Alito, he wrote the majority opinion on this. Did he also write the other majority opinion on the other one? You can look it up.
Yes.
But the power of Justice Alito is significant on this conservative-led court.
Right. He says the text is clear. He's looking at the statute itself. And said that the federal law prohibits courts from second-guessing administration's determination, in this case, to strip the protections. He says the text is clear, plain meaning is very broad, and so he almost says we are compelled by virtue of the language that Congress put together. No other result, according to Alito. Obviously, the three so-called liberal justices, Kagan and Sotomayor and Brown Jackson, quoting extensively from some derogatory comments, frankly, the president made about Haitian immigrants and obviously opposing this result. They are the losers in this case. They're the three of the 6-3. And again, the decision very much in favor of the administration with respect to TPS termination.
Direct quote from Justice Sotomayor, people will die as a result of these two decisions.
Right. The statements fairly shout, he's talking about the president, there are racial undertones and overtones alike, that race entered into the president's resolve to remove Haitians from this country. Again, that's Elena Kagan in opposition to what Justice Alito has said.
It'll be interesting to see what the president has to say about this because it is clear win on the two cases. There's other cases as well that are being decided, or that were decided this morning. We'll get to those and a lot more with our guest legal expert, former U.S. Attorney James Santel, Jim Santel, for all of you who have listened to him on our program often. She's Chris and I'm Steve. It's Point Taken on a very important Thursday right here on 620 WTMJ. Former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel joins us for the entire hour as we break down the breaking decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court. It is interesting, Jim, that some of the ones that, you know, a lot of focus on birthright citizenship, the mail-in ballot question.
Right. Campaign finance is still out there.
Transgender athletes
are still out there, right?
So those, exactly. Those are looming for, what, Monday, Tuesday?
Probably so, right. And the real big ones we're still looking for are the cases involving are the firings of regulators, both inside the Federal Reserve and Federal Trade Commission. That has to do with presidential power. As significant as what we're talking about this morning in connection with these immigration cases, the asylum matter, the reality is that power case, those are the ones we're really going to be looking for to see what the Supreme Court really wants to say about executive authority.
So the other ones for today, because I know we're gonna, there's ones on guns and there's one on Monsanto. And
yes.
So with the 4 minutes that we have, which is an easier one to cover.
Let's talk about let's do guns. I think as dramatic
it
as that
is. It takes us to Hawaii.
Absolutely, right? Yeah. Exactly. Hawaii passes gun laws. And basically requiring gun owners to get advance permission to carry weapons onto private property, generally open to the public. Think about, for example, gas stations or shopping malls, those kinds of things where you all go. And the question is whether or not, that is permissible. The Supreme Court, again, it appears to be a 6-3 opinion coming out of Justice Alito once again, saying the Hawaii law issue that restricts that violates the constitutional right to keep and bear arms. Striking down this Hawaii law that requires, once again, gun owners to get permission before carrying a firearm onto private property, again, like grocery stores, that sort of thing. It is certainly, is one of two guns cases, this term. The last one from last week has something to do with this marijuana user who had challenged a provision that had banned drug users from owning or possessing guns. There, once again, generally an opinion that's viewed as being supportive of Second Amendment rights, permitting this particular fellow in that other case to go ahead and own the gun, even though he has had been a user of marijuana. Today, once again, arguably a larger case because it has to do with a use and carrying of guns where you can go with those.
Well, that's what I mean, for people who are very protective over private property and private business owners having rules over what they, you know, it's like we refuse the right to not serve you if you're not wearing a shirt, if you're not wearing shoes, if you are carrying a gun. And so does this not infringe on that?
That is exactly, Kristen, what they had argued. And this was, again, this is why this particular issue, frankly, pits some people who might be otherwise in the same side of the political aisle, right? Property owners versus and gun owners. And so it's an interesting case just for that reason, playing the dissenters in part saying, yeah, this should be about property rights. And I should, if I am the owner of a grocery store, I should be able to post something in my front door that says, you know what? Yeah, you are welcome to come in here and engage in business, but you just can't carry your gun.
Well, because I'm thinking of, this makes me think about Milwaukee, and there are certain clubs where you get wanded before you walk into that nightclub.
Right, right.
And so does this fly in the face of that, that someone can now challenge and sue a nightclub in Milwaukee for saying, I'm allowed to bring my gun into a nightclub?
Right. And so Ketanji Brown Jackson, again, is saying sort of just that to the extent she says that we have a test that relates to historical regulation, all the history regulation taken into account. I think there might be something wrong with the test is what she's talking about, the Bruin test. But she is the one who is, again, opposing what the Supreme Court has done and saying that, Sam Alito, you're just plain wrong. And, again, implementation means everything. We're still figuring out exactly what this means for all those property owners out there who have those signs in their windows. Can you now walk in, concealed carry, and disregard that statement on the door?
A future clash, property rights versus gun rights. Mm-hmm. Because I love audience feedback. Pam said this about our last conversation, previous segment. After 26 years of working in and with a community in Haiti, I'm sick. Mass deportation to Haiti, if it happens at this time, will exasperate an already horrendous situation. 6 million Haitians are on the verge of starvation as it is. Our school meal program can only feed the 450 students in our partner school 3 days a week because of cost and supply issues. A listener providing some real-time feedback.
And a great comment. Why? Because we forget all these cases have names, right? It's U.S. versus Himani. It's all the other cases we're talking about here. And it's sometimes easy to think, well, geez, the Supreme Court just wakes up this morning and says, I'm going to issue this opinion. These are all about human beings, individual human beings, and they have a huge impact upon residents and citizens alike of America.
Keep the feedback coming, 855-616-1620, the Saudi Unlimited and WTMJ talk and text line. Lots more to talk about with former U.S. attorney, brilliant attorney, and certainly our legal expert here, one of our legal experts here on Point Taken. Interesting that the justices are pushing back on the 6-3 thing because they like to cite now all the unanimous decisions.
Yes.
Which is half.
And there are some.
Real quick, we got to go to ABC.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, along always with Steve Scafidi, and we are talking to former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel, breaking down today's decisions from the United States Supreme Court. And we had a text asking for clarification on the Hawaii gun rule that we were just talking about before the news. So the question was, regarding the Hawaiian law, they were requiring explicit permission before you could carry, meaning the assumption is guns are never allowed unless a notice permitting them is posted. I believe individual businesses can still post a restriction of guns on their private property.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And so it is about explicit permission. It's that portion of the state's law. Again, Hawaii has these laws that are quite prohibitive, and it's based upon their tradition. That's the issue before the Supreme Court. Appreciate very much the clarification. And the other point in response to one of your other questions, Kristen, the lawyers who are defending this said that this historical reference, the Bruin test, that it flows from this history and the tradition of the islands and the rest of the country. State, again, Hawaii long had some of the tightest gun regulations. So they're saying, listen, we've done this historically under the Bruin test, which is what the Supreme Court always applies. This should pass muster, even though it is very strident.
What is the Bruin test?
So Bruin is the one that was decided, again, a number of years ago, coming out of New York, that says in order to justify restrictions, conditions, limitations on Second Amendment rights, you have to look to the past. You've got to find some historical analog. You don't have to have a twin necessarily, but be able to look back and say, listen, we did this in the past. Gets a lot of criticism because the question is, what is the past? You go back to James Madison and look at whether or not he would understand what an AR-15 is or what, you know, a ghost gun is. The standard that's still in place, well, it's being chipped away a bit. There was another case, again, a couple of sessions ago in which the Supreme Court said, yes, you can limit people who are the subjects of domestic violence restraining orders. Plainly, that hasn't been a part of our history, but they said that one's okay. Bruin basically says, in order to justify limitations, you have to look to history. And it is not without its great criticisms out there, including members of the Supreme Court. An awful lot of people say this is going to eventually, over time, fall, just because you can't describe everything in 2026 based upon something that happened in 1776. And that's the problem with it.
Interesting commentary. I'm reading some live commentary. Apparently, at the reading of some of the decisions, Alito and Sotomayor got into it as she was reading the dissent. So Justice Alito, he likes to flex.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Justice Sotomayor on the other side.
Right.
And that conflict is on full display.
And it's not unprecedented to do that when you have especially dissenters who want to say, listen, I'm going to publish this. You can read about it. I'm going out there on the bench today and with the media there, and I'm going to read portions of my dissent. They're not going to read all of it. And they're making a special point. This is becoming more and more usual as the dissension, if you will, quite literally between the justices, becomes more part of the public domain.
Alito described the process and the decision as making the policies orderly and humane. Sotomayor disagreed. All right. Other decision today, Jim?
Yes. So we've also got, I'll just mention just very, very much in passing, and not today, but actually last week, this case involving the Rastafarian whose dreadlocks were forcibly shaven by prison guards. The Supreme Court last week, 6-3 vote in a major case. It's probably the singular significant case with respect to religious rights and free exercise under the First Amendment, saying that he did not, under the particular statute in which he brought his case, does not have the right to file a lawsuit against the individuals who did that to him. And so an awful lot of people looking at this fellow, his name is Landor, is Damon Landor, and says, I'm disappointed, should not happen to anyone else. It is arguably, again, one of the significant cases in a long line, lots of focus by the Supreme Court on religious liberty. Here, they're making a determination that under the statute, he does not have the ability to file this lawsuit against individual jailers who shaved his dreadlocks when he was being transferred from one prison to the other.
And then finally, for the first opinion that came out today was Monsanto versus Gernell, and it held that the law governing pesticides, pesticide labels, bars a lawsuit against Monsanto.
Right. And so once again, the Supreme Court making a decision about what the statute says here and what the capacity is to file lawsuits like this. Plainly a victory, if you will, for big industry and the folks who are a loss, if you will, for environmentalists who are hoping to bring this lawsuit against them. Yeah.
Texter asked this question, going back to our previous conversation. Public places are schools, mm-hmm. I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are guns more important than people is their statement. How does that sort of conflict?
Sure. So in all these guns cases, and many of them, right, we've got a lot of amicus briefs being filed by people who are not necessarily parties to the lawsuits, but raise exactly those kinds of issues, Steve and Kristen, who say, wait a minute, I may not be a person who is directly involved in this, but I have an interest in it because of my country, my education, and want to bring to the court's attention something that it may not be considering. That particular perspective, that is the analogies to other places, certainly the Supreme Court appreciates that, but that kind of voice, important for the Supreme Court to hear, even from people who are not participating in oral argument in front of the Supreme Court.
All right. Well, when we come back, we're not going to talk about a Supreme Court decision, but we are going to talk about maybe something that could end up in the Supreme Court, because the Postmaster General told lawmakers yesterday that the USPS will no longer deliver mail-in ballots in states that refuse to provide voter data to the federal government. So let's talk about that with former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel on the other side of this. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bry along with Steve Scafidi, and going through getting our legal, our own
right,
SCOTUS
right.
blog right
I'm
here.
Like, on the fly
Santel.
Here as we're reading opinions on the air. It's a good thing.
All right. So this has been in the news, but as of yesterday, Postmaster General David Steiner testified mm-hmm. in front of Congress that the U.S. Post Office will no longer deliver mail-in ballots in states that refuse to provide voter information. So that includes Wisconsin, because we have not turned over that information. Is this legal?
Right. And so according to Senator Gary Peters, who's Michigan, right, based, he says, he makes the point very clear. He asks, if a state like Wisconsin, like Michigan, refuses to turn over their absentee voter list, which is what the administration is asking for, will the Post Service still mail the ballots under this proposed rule? And Postmaster General Steiner says, under a proposed regulation, no. Can't be any more clear than that. And so lawsuits already filed challenging this. Again, the quasi-independent status of the Postal Service for a long period of time. Obviously, I also represent the Postal Service when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office, as do others in the civil side of things. And it appears right now we've got another rule coming out of this administration with respect to the delivery of mail that could have a huge, as you just pointed out, Kristen, huge impact on what's going to happen in this calendar year.
Well, I mean, it's one thing for Wisconsin, who we're not turning over data, and we have not as many as in 2020 as far as people voting by mail. But what does this mean for states that are also blue states that I have to imagine are not turning over their voter data, like Oregon, Washington, California, that heavily rely on mail-in ballots?
And the other footnote to this, of course, is you've got federal district court judges in many of those places saying you don't have to. The administration is losing on the question of whether or not they're obliged to turn over those voter lists and information to the Department of Justice. So, again, we've got a government, capital G, largely writ, telling you different things in different directions. Somebody's got to straighten this out very quickly, including this summer before this goes much further.
What bothers me is you've taken a situation where individuals within the postal system, and I respect it like you do, it creates opportunity for hijinks and shenanigans, because an individual or a group of people could remove ballots, store ballots, hide ballots, then... Where a problem didn't exist, my opinion, before, now you've created an opportunity for
it. Well, and even if it's not malicious, as far as individual postal workers who are like mixed messages as far as what are we supposed to be doing.
People reading the headline even today, which is a little bit more than I'm doing right now in reading these headlines, and saying, well, the Postmaster General just told us we're not supposed to deliver, again, we may not have absentee ballots right now, but we're not supposed to deliver things. People read headlines, good-natured, intentional, purposeful decisions not to deliver things. Based upon a lack of clarity, and that's the problem right now. It got to be cleared up so we've got.
Because remind, where are we with ballot boxes in Wisconsin right now? Will there be ballot boxes this fall for people to drop off their mail-in ballot?
Let me check on that again. And make certain that I'm accurate before telling you exactly what it is. I suspect listeners may know that. But again, all these kinds of things need to be absolutely clarified before we go forward.
All right. Jim Santel, former U.S. attorney and our legal expert here on Point Taken with Kristen and Steve. We will take a break, and then I want Jim to sort of give us his closing argument on what these decisions today and potentially what happens next week, Monday or Tuesday, with the U.S. Supreme Court mean for all of us and our country. We'll do that after this on 620 WTMJ.
Now it's time for your closing arguments.
U.S. attorney, former Jim Santel, you have the floor.
Steve, Kristen, thank you so very much. Just one purposeful focus on the question that you raised just before the break, Kristen, about drop boxes in Wisconsin. The reason I was stammering was because I recalled in the moment the Supreme Court had gone back and forth in that. 2022, they said no boxes. 4-3 decision in 2024, basically reversing that near total ban, permitting drop boxes going forward. So perhaps there's some reason for my confusion about this, given the courts being all over the place on this as well.
And I don't want to step over your closing arguments, but that is, I mean, this is bad changing information on voting laws is voter suppression, right? Because, and so that's why it is really good for us to get the information right, but it's gone back and forth a lot. So that's why I'm glad we clarified.
Lots of these rules doing that sort of thing. So we were talking this morning about these major Supreme Court decisions. We got a lot of them, as Steve and Kristen, you've also said. We're waiting for those next Monday and Tuesday. We've got birthright citizenship, probably not going to be supporting the president's position under the 14th Amendment. Speaking about campaigns, we've got mail-in ballots. Can you count them after Election Day? What about political parties supporting individual candidates? That's still coming up. We've got transgender athletes. Can transgender women participate in sports? And beyond that, the big ones yet to be decided, having to do with the power of the presidency to terminate people who are the leaders in independent agencies, including the Federal Reserve, Federal Trade Commission. May well be that the Supreme Court is going to split on those. Watch that to see how they justify if they do indeed make those decisions. The larger issue here is just this. If you look at all these things, we've got death penalty cases, free speech cases, immigration issues, guns, birthright citizenship, campaigns, all these kinds of issues. And where are they being decided in America today? 9 people in the United States Supreme Court. We've said this before. We've had this discussion before. Voting Rights Act, basically, Calais, the tariffs issues, all those kinds of things. Not that the Supreme Court does not have a role to play. Absolutely. They'd resolve differences between parties as we talked on a regular basis. Would we not feel a whole lot more satisfied if, as we look at this thing called the Constitution, that we looked at the first article, that the legislature was making decisions about these kinds of things? You want clarity on sort of these things? It's the legislature that should be doing it. My advocacy is that on all these, yes, they have weighed in. They need to reassert their authority when it comes to representing you and me and making the decisions, whatever those may be. Whatever those may be, legislatively make the decision, pass the laws, and do not defer to a Supreme Court that more and more is making policy for America. That should happen across the parking lot of that big domed building in our nation's capital.
Those legislative decisions, whether it's the U.S. Congress or the state legislature in the state of wherever you are, that should provide clarity. But when they remove themselves and allow the court process to handle it gives us the mess that we have.
And you vacate the field. And so many of these cases, we talked just sort of off the air, you've got the Supreme Court saying, especially when it comes to transgender issues, other things out there having to do with human issues and even some commercial issues, we're going to defer to some legislators, state legislatures in particular. Okay, that's the Supreme Court in part saying it's beyond our expertise. And they do say that from time to time. It's fairly rare, but they do say that. Let's take them up on that and say, you know what, when we elect people to the Congress, 435 members in November and a third of the Senate, send them to Congress and say, we want you to address these issues related to campaign finance issues. And we want you to address issues related to guns and the role of independent agencies. You can pass legislation in all these areas. You can pass legislation that addresses Calais and those other cases that have brought, in many ways, the Voting Rights Act to its knees. You can change the law tomorrow. Do it.
I mean, we only have 30 seconds, but it is, if you were a betting person, as far as things that would change over the next, let's say, 10 years, that would undo some of these decisions for people who are unhappy with them, you think it's more likely to happen in the legislature or because there will be a different makeup of the Supreme Court?
Probably the latter. Again, it's going to be a while, right? No immediate departures from the Supreme Court, and even if there are, not a huge change. It would be a good thing if a part of your analysis of who you vote for this coming November would be, regardless of your party, will you promise to take these issues up and make some decisions? That would be the thing that should be a part of the campaign coming up here.
Jim Santel, thanks for sharing your wisdom, and thanks for jumping in the schedule pretty quick. When we realize some decisions,
always are honored to be with you.
Always smarter after you're here.
Absolutely, and the audience, the text we get also suggests the same thing. They appreciate
delighted to be
wisdom.
With you.
All right, we'll take a break for news. Then Jerry Mangione, UrbanMilwaukee.com, all things local. After this,
11 o'clock on a Thursday means it's time for a full hour of city stories with Urban Milwaukee President Jeremy Mangione on Point Taken.
Oh, not just president, founder, janitor, sales guy, broadcaster. There's so many
buyer
hats you wear, Jeremy Mangione.
And yet I'm not a hat guy.
Really? But maybe you will be future in life because I'm debating that.
Too good of hair to be a hat guy.
He's got good thick hair. That's a good thing to have in life. All right. We always talk about local when you come down from UrbanMilwaukee.com's towers in Milwaukee, not towers. So let's start with the big one.
The big one. My alderman.
Yeah, he's so proud, I'm sure.
Power to the people over We Energies. It's an issue Alex Brower made his number one thing when he was running for the common council seat last year in early 2025. He was then elected and things were a little bit quiet. The council has taken some unified actions to essentially throw their hand in the air and say, hey, we oppose this We Energies rate increase along with dozens of other entities. And that's, I believe, happened twice since Alex has been in office. But for the first time, the, quote, Power to the People campaign, which is an entity that's largely affiliated with the Milwaukee Democratic Socialist for America chapter, had a formal hearing at City Hall. It lasted 3 hours yesterday over can the city take over We Energies, the electric portion of We Energies, not the gas? Like, what's the legality of that? What are the things you need to think about? And so over a course of, again, 3 hours, you had more than an hour of people saying, yes, we support this, and almost everyone self-identifying that spoke as a member of the local DSA chapter. But you had a representative from the American Public Power Association kind of walk through what is commonly seen, and Milwaukee would be a very unusual case. Lots of public power utilities, there are 82 of them in Wisconsin, are small communities. The largest is Manitowoc, and they also weren't created by taking over an existing entity. Right. They were often created 100 years ago from the ground up. So that's a wrinkle. You had an attorney from Pines Bach, which is in a Madison law firm, kind of going through the hairy details that the city would need to consider. There is in state law, section 197 defines how all this would work, but largely it would end up in the courtroom where the city of Milwaukee would be going against We Energies. They would go get appraisals and they would attempt to buy We Energies electric equipment in the city of Milwaukee.
Do we have the money to do that?
The argument from some of the proponents is yes, because you could back it all with revenue bonds. So the money you get to buy it would be future rates you would pay. Now, the wrinkle on that and the thing that wasn't discussed at length yesterday is if you want to make power cheaper, you can't add new debt service on top of your expenses. That would be something that makes your power more expensive. Alex Brower, at one point, speaking to a dispatcher from We Energies who showed up and said the city shouldn't gamble on this. So this is someone that works for We Energies, represents one of the unions that works with We Energies, said, don't gamble on this. And he said, hey, we actually want to make your job better. We just don't want the CEO to have a job. And so that's kind of the political resistance here is you have this push against the 10% profit margin We Energies is allowed to have by the state and the large executive pay package that Gail Klappa has historically had.
Wouldn't it make more sense to spend all your time and energy trying to focus on that 10% profit margin if that's your beef and that's one of the reasons you're moving in this direction? Because here's my thing. Look, I'm not happy about high energy bills. I had some of the highest I've ever had for my house in Oak Creek in this last winter. So I don't like it. I don't think anybody likes paying more for their energy. But I've talked about it in previous shows and maybe even on this show about some of the problems states have when they start to split things up. And Texas is a great example. They have brownouts all the time. They have consistent power outages. We don't generally have that. We have them, but they're storm related.
They're all storm related.
Yeah.
Yes.
But in Texas, it's mainly because there's heat at some point and people are using too much AC. But to the point, I don't understand why this one would be his top priority. And two, you're not going to make it cheaper. And I guess number three, who says in this case that the city or county is going to do a better job than We Energy is providing power to the citizens of Milwaukee?
And I'm already forgetting your first question, so sorry. But yeah. I'll attempt to answer
there's a lot there.
Broad spectrum of what you're going at. The big thing that came out of yesterday's meeting was Alderman Robert Bauman, a longtime critic of We Energies, although someone who hasn't explicitly endorsed this idea, said, okay, I think what we need next is a dedicated task force at the city of council members, of administration officials, and we need a legitimate feasibility study to try and answer many of those issues you were just raising. Like, would it be cheaper? Actually, Bauman was like, well, We Energies has all these trucks. Like, do we buy a prorated portion of them? And the Public Power Association was like, no, you buy none of them. So, okay, what does it cost to go out and buy trucks if you're only buying the physical power lines? All those are big questions that need to be answered. I do think it's fair to have real concerns about, can you actually provide power cheaper? Now, that might not be Alex Brower's only motive. In his opening remarks, he talked about wanting democracy in every aspect of a citizen's life. And so for him, he just wants partially public control of the utility, which the city has with its waterworks, but he wants it for the electric service as well.
So is there a compromise there as far as the city or the county having more input control as a shareholder, whether financially or not, but I would assume financially, in We Energies, that isn't a complete takeover?
I don't know that there's a compromise there. Steve actually hit on what might be the biggest issue. If you are really concerned about We Energies rates and you really wanted to reduce them, the easiest and to be very, very hard thing you could do that is specific to We Energies, not to the macro environment of energy prices, is push for their allowed rate of return, which is currently 10%, go down to 9.5%, 9.25%. All that would immediately reduce your electrical rates.
And would that be, was that a state law? Like, which law, at what body of government has to be able to change that?
That's at the Public Service Commission, which is a 3-member body that oversees all the monopolies in the state. They're currently, because he's been in office long enough, all Tony Evers appointees.
Oh, and that is who also sets the rates.
Yes, they set the rate structure.
If you've been following data centers at all, you now know what the PSC is, which a year ago I did not. But right, as far as understanding and who is appointed and some of the revolving door that happens as far as people who worked at We Energies that are now on the PSC and some of the politics around that.
Yes, it's a complicated thing.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and I might be, but there used to be, and perhaps there still is, a program for people who have trouble making their electric bill payments. assistance is provided. I think we all sort of pay a little bit on our bills for that program.
That came up repeatedly yesterday because there was the thought.
Is that true?
That program does exist. Off the top of my head, I can't remember the name. But in the coldest months of the year, We Energies cannot, or any Correct. Utility in yes. Wisconsin, cannot disconnect you.
Yep.
And it helps reduce your power rates as well. And then what kept coming up is, well, if the city took over, they wouldn't do that. And what we know from the Milwaukee Water Works is the city does, in fact, even take your house if you don't pay your water bill.
Right.
Because it gets added to your property tax bill at the end of the day.
Go ahead.
Well, no, because we have to go to break. But is it worth it all, whether today or a different day, because of what happened in New York this week in the elections? As we said, Alex Brower is part of Milwaukee's DSA chapter. Is it worth having a conversation at all as far as like the strength of the DSA in Milwaukee or Wisconsin at large?
Absolutely. We have some interesting divides in our DSA locally, where Ryan Clancy is perhaps the most prominent Milwaukee socialist elected, but is not strongly aligned anymore with Milwaukee DSA.
All right. Do we want to talk about that when we come back? I know that was not in the lineup.
We'll save it for another day.
All right, we'll save it for another day.
All right, Jerry Magini, UrbanMilwaukee.com. Kristen and Steve, point taken. 620 WTMJ. He is Jeremy Janine. All kinds of important positions at UrbanMilwaukee.com. It's a great read. And if you are interested in local government, Milwaukee, city, county, and all the stories that the shape, the sort of where we go as a city and a county, it's the best, one of the best resources out there. So we're going to shift gears now. What are we talking about now?
We have something that we're going to go up possibly a lot. A 25-story building is proposed for downtown Milwaukee. On its own, we've had a lot of that recently. We've had 25-story housing buildings proposed for downtown Milwaukee and built. On its own, I mean, newsworthy, but not huge news. But what's different here is Newland Enterprises at the corner of Van Buren and Kilbourne is now proposing a 25-story condominium tower. They're calling it a signature condominium tower because of its scale, both its height and 226 units. And the big deal is condos. I mean, people shorthand use that for apartments, but the difference there is condos you can own,
mm-hmm.
apartments you rent. And so this would create 226 new homeowners in downtown Milwaukee, be the first time in two decades we've really had any condo development in downtown since the Great Recession.
Well, and that's a big, I remember covering this a couple years ago, of like that is creating such a huge bottleneck for kind of what we saw as a natural progression of as people become empty nesters, wanting to downsize. But the prospect of downsizing your house that's maybe paid off or your mortgage that's next to nothing, and then going and paying $3,000 for rent every month is not a really good value proposition. And so there's so many people who are staying in their homes longer and thus adding to the housing shortage. And so like this is a big deal. But explain to us why there was this two-decade basically moratorium on developers making the investment to do condos.
Yes, there are a couple different things that happen. One is Newland in particular knows there's liability with developing a condo that you don't have with developing apartments. You sell the building to all kinds of other people, and 2 years later, they can turn around and sue you about construction defects.
Right.
And since there wasn't a lot of urban housing construction into the 1990s and 2000s, there wasn't a lot of expertise, so there was a lot of defects. That became an issue. There's a financing challenge. It's simply harder to finance a condominium development than it is an apartment building. And then the biggest thing was low interest rates fueled with an absence of new apartments. There was a vacuum, and developers filled it by developing the easiest thing that the market was demanding, which was apartments. And it was just easy to finance. Everyone understood it from lenders and on down, architects, and you saw a huge wave of them develop.
So then what's shifted that is now, for at least Newland, saying that this is a worthy investment?
So two major things have happened. One, it seems like the appetite for apartments has been satisfied. We've seen slower lease-ups than expected with some of the newest high-end towers. And then, according to Tim Gockman, managing director at Newland Enterprises, the value of homes in the Milwaukee area is now growing faster than the cost of new construction, which creates a gap where you can start to finance condominiums. So even though construction costs continue to rise really quickly, housing construction or housing prices are outpacing that growth.
Any significant public pushback on this idea?
Not so far. And Mayor Cavalier Johnson and Alderman Robert Bauman were present at an event Monday night to champion this development. They're both very clear about the tax base impacts from this. If you sold all 226 units at their different price ranges, you end up with a final sales price for the entire building of about $190 million. That's something like $3.5 to $4.5 million in new tax revenue for the city, county, MPS every year.
And just to get context as far as where this would be really close to the Newland's other building, the Ascent.
Yeah,
which is a timber building.
Ironically, 15 years ago, Newland had looked at both these sites and created a proposal called Bookends that never got built. They're actually now building the Bookends, just not by that name. You have Ascent across the street, an apartment tower, mass timber, so it's got that aesthetic wood appeal. And then you'll have this concrete tower, which they have a design with engineering that is beamless. So a lot of condominium buildings, you think of that exposed ceiling with kind of pipes that have to weave around everything. That won't be the case here. It'll be nice flat ceilings, which they think will be a real competitive advantage.
In my opinion, nice addition to the skyline, 25 stories. That's
very tall.
Well, it'll be right by Grace, like Cathedral Square.
Yeah.
And so adding more foot traffic to that area.
And their competitive edge versus other condominium developments, they believe not only this beamless design, that it's a new building, but it's going to have lots of amenities because of the scale, indoor, outdoor pool, all kinds of stuff.
Jeremy Janine, UrbanMilwaukee.com is where you can find his and his great reporter's work. We're going cruising after this on 620 WTMJ's Point Taken. All right, I saw the cruise ship, I think it was yesterday, American Cruise Lines.
American Cruise Lines, new to Milwaukee, not new to cruising. They've done the Mississippi River cruises for years. If you're a radio listener, you may be familiar, but you might not, of the 1886 Passenger Vessel Services Act.
Kristen, are you aware of that?
No.
Which is very important about what we're going to discuss. It's a protectionist trade measure, similar to the Jones Act, which is better known. But it says if you have a foreign flagged vessel, you cannot transport passengers between two American ports. So we could not get on a British ship in Milwaukee and take it to Chicago. That would be illegal. So what you see with Viking cruises, Pearl Seas, all these other cruise lines that have entered the Great Lakes is the cruises are like Toronto to Milwaukee, Cleveland to whatever, insert Canadian city. They all have that kind of pairing going on. We now have, for the first time in many, many decades, first, we'll say modern cruising on the Great Lakes, an American-made and American-staffed vessel, which allows it to go an entire journey between American ports. No legal requirement to leave the United States, which they said yesterday, their captain, Jerry Smith, that you don't have to bring your passport when you go on this cruise, which is unique among the Great Lakes. They have a brand new vessel, the American Patriot. It's even got some 250th anniversary decals on it. Relatively small. We talked about that Viking ship, absolutely huge, 600 some feet long, 300 some passengers. This is 200 and about 40 feet, 130 passengers.
And that's why it docks in a different place, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's also part of American Cruise Lines, a sister companies with the Pearl Seas, which already has an exclusive agreement or a priority agreement for the Discovery World dock, which is called Pier Wisconsin. The reason Viking doesn't come there is because their boat won't fit. It's not dredged deep enough there. But you'll see it 8 times this year, so I'm assuming it's left by now in the day. But 7 more times, this new cruise ship, the American Patriot, will be in harbor right by Discovery World. And yet another cruise line entering Milwaukee.
I'm interested, are they more affordable? Because I've looked at some of the prices for, and because I think some of the Midwest, the Great Lake cruises look incredible. I would love to go on them with my parents. But they are not cheap. Is this a similar price point, or do you know?
I can tell you the price point. A 14-day, 13-night Buffalo to Milwaukee cruise starts at $12,800. So by no one's definition, cheap. When it actually comes to cruising, my parents are on a cruise right now. Like, I threw out this $1,000 a day
figure. That's the going rate.
And that's
it's $1,000 a day?
Basically. Yeah. Okay. So a week would be half of that, $7,000. Yeah.
Okay.
It actually is slightly cheaper.
But I guess it's like, and when you get that, I've never been on a cruise. So like all the food, lodging, everything is included, basically.
For the most part, excursion every day. So
they pamper you for 2 weeks or a week.
Would you say it's worth it, Steve?
I would, because I've been on a ton of these.
That's what I mean. You have more experience. Have you been on a cruise?
I have not.
Yeah, see? These broke millennials over here. No money, no cruise money over here.
As I often say when people say that, I say aspire to it. When you get to be my age, I wasn't doing it when I was your age.
Fair.
Come on, kids. All right, a queen, the king of custard, and a number of religious leaders. What do they all have in common? Jeremy's going to answer that question.
Excellent tease.
Oh, well, you wrote it, so therefore that's probably why you're self-promoting. That's what you're doing there. So we're going to get to all of that. If it's Thursday, that means it's JJ time. Here in Janine, UrbanMilwaukee.com. Great local resource for news. This one's just, the tease you wrote captured my attention. A queen, the king of custard, a number of Religious leaders, and the answer to that hook is?
There are 17 people that have been honored with honorary street signs, which are the blue signs you see hanging underneath the green sign.
When's that Stephen Christen sign going up? Point
Do you have to apply for this?
Well, I have an
I would.
You either have
I would on your behalf. Sorry.
Two qualifications, both of which, thankfully, you, well, one of them, thankfully, you don't qualify yet. City created this program in 2005. By 2020, there was only 25 of these designations. Now there's more than 70, so they're proliferating. But there's two restrictions, and they've had to reject some of them recently because of this. You have to be, unfortunately, passed away.
Oh, okay.
Or you have to be...
Then we don't want it.
We don't, yeah, we don't want it. We don't want that.
Or you have to be at least 70 years old.
You don't have that,
either. Yep, so... Stephen Christen Wade.
Those are good criteria, honestly. As we were talking about who gets things named after them, I think we were saying having been passed, not being with us any longer may be a good
Yeah, otherwise, the problem is that current leaders name stuff after themselves, which is weird. And
that's a very
tacky. Is that the word you were looking for?
Yeah, well, I have a lot of words for it, but I'll leave it at that.
So the legends in Milwaukee that have got things named after them, the Queen, Cecilia Gilbert. Steve, I bet you knew one of these people in Oak Creek. Cecilia worked for the city of Milwaukee in various capacities for several decades. She was just one of those people that if you needed something done, you would call Cecilia. She was the liaison for the Department of Public Works to get your permits for all kinds of things. So like filming movies came to her, all those type of things.
I barely knew her, but I knew that she had like instant access to everything, like knew all the stuff, knew all the people, and that's the connection point that a lot of people needed.
So Cecilia's honored on the south side of Cathedral Square Park, leading into Taylor's, where she could frequently be found with other city employees after work. And then going north from Taylor's on Jefferson, this is the king of Custard, Carl Kopp is honored.
Mm.
And
that's a good one.
Why there? It's because Carl Kopp owns Elsa's on the park, which I never knew why it was called Elsa's. In the process of researching the story, I learned it's named after his mother.
I didn't know that either.
Wow. I didn't know that he owned that.
Oh, yeah. That's you can usually.
They serve their ice cream there or custard there?
It's got a great burger is what I always know
they
Elsa's
do.
For. People like wings there.
Yeah. I haven't been to Elsa's in a while. It's a good reminder.
Mm-hmm. So many other people. Bishop Sedgwick Daniels is a big one. His organization, Holy Redeemer Institutional Church of God, was in the news recently because the property they own burned down in pretty dramatic fashion on Hampton and 32nd. And now Hampton Avenue is honorarily named for him. I'll just read through a bunch of other names and fire them away. Look them up if you're interested. We have them all in Urban Milwaukee. Betty Hayes is on West Garfield Avenue. George Harriet DeReef, someone I didn't know at all, but was a pioneering black attorney when there was only three in Milwaukee more than 100 years ago. Otha Howard, a pastor. Carl Hunt, which is a former volleyball coach at Rufus King High School. A personal favorite of mine, Mary McCormick, who retires next week as the head of the Rotary Club of Milwaukee.
Oh, that's why I know that name. Yeah, yeah.
Prospect Avenue, and I'm on the board of Rotary Club of Milwaukee, I should disclose. The Prospect,
good job.
Prospect Avenue going into the War Memorial Center where the club meets. John McVicker, the head of Christ the King Baptist Church. Everett Moore, who created the bar that is now known as Garfield's 502. He also created the Garfield Street Festival. Clarence Parrish, the first black person to win a contested judicial election in Milwaukee. Ron Sadoff, an investment advisor who created Milwaukee College Prep. Shirley Smith, Sherry Trotum, Rabbi Michael Twersky, who is also a well-known composer.
Hmm.
And then here's a confusing one, J.C. Williams and John J. Williams both have streets named after them now.
All right.
That seems like a good list, a nice representative of the whole spectrum.
And if I plotted them out on a map, they covered the entire city, including way up to 122nd and Green Tree Road.
And did you say how long do they stay up? How long does the...
They're up forever now.
They're up forever now. Okay.
Real life question. Does the family maybe of these people who are being honored like this, do they get a replica of the street sign?
That's my business partner, Dave Reed, knew Cecilia really well and helped coordinate that one. And they presented her son and her family replicas.
That's cool.
The costs are all covered by the nominees.
All right. Somebody once called me many years ago on the show, a Domes hater. I actually like the Domes. I've chaperoned. It's been a while, but I chaperoned high school dances there. I went to weddings there, went to parties there. Domes is getting some strong support from donors.
Yeah, they've crossed the 50% mark on
That's
their.
That's good.
They have a $133 million project. $17 million of it is private philanthropic support. They're over $9 million now. They are on track, says Executive Director Krista Beal Defic, to break ground between April of 2027 and December of 2028, which is what the county is requiring for its $30 million contribution.
And this will look like what when they.
renovated.
A substantial renovation to the three existing domes. The common spaces get dramatically improved, and then there's some new accessory structures being developed as well. So it becomes the place that Steve will want to go to for his grandkids' events.
Yeah, I mean, it is, whatever you think about it, it's an iconic destination, or at least it's something you see on the freeway and you can drive by. And a lot of people still go there and enjoy the different environments, the plant environments. And as a gardener slash landscaper, amateur, I love that.
And one thing we should note, just because the timing is perfect, the corpse flower is going to bloom any day now. And
always exciting.
It draws a long line. If you're a Domus member, you get to skip the line.
It also stinks.
It smells ridiculous. Go see.
Yeah. It's, well, and like
it's just for the
rotting corpse.
Yeah.
It's a huge flower.
It's huge, so people line up just to be able to smell it?
Correct. Yeah. Some people wait.
You've never done this?
I've never
done this. Didn't the museum have it once? I thought they had it once.
I don't know. It is on wheels at the end of the day.
I thought the museum had it like many years ago. Anyway. Lots more to get to with Jeremy and Janine. UrbanMilwaukee.com is where you can find their great work. You should subscribe. We'll take a break. Chris and Steve, Point Taken on a Thursday, right here on 620 WTMJ.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bry, along with Steve Scafidi and Jeremy Janine of Urban Milwaukee. All right, we're going to keep this short, but complicated financing plan will pay for paving, playground, and more near Century City.
In the middle of Milwaukee, just like Jaslyn teed up with the Jimmy Eat World song, a trio of tax incremental financing districts. What's happening here is the city 20 years ago had these ambitious plans to kind of do more redevelopment around the 30th Street corridor. It struggled to make a lot of that work. It had to bail a lot of that out with overperforming TIF districts downtown. It might have, the city perhaps intentionally, bailed them out probably more than they needed to. Now there's a little bit of surplus at the end of a lot of these districts. The West Basin Project, which is an MMSD project to retain 30 million gallons of rainwater, is going to get a $750,000 playground as part of it. There's going to be a massive amount of repaving, a number of street lighting projects all around one of the city's most impoverished neighborhoods. Area Alderwoman Andrea Pratt calls it a huge win. She's happy she can deliver for constituents. This is an unusual example of how downtown, its wealth benefits the central city, because that transfer to bail out these underperforming TIF districts made it possible at the end of their life to be able to actually do good for the neighborhood.
Yeah, as a guy who was involved in a lot of TIF projects, I think this is a great development for that area. It should be well received.
And then the other thing I wanted to talk about, and Steve was teasing during our break about what we're going to talk about next, but I bet he has stories about this too. Sixth Street used to be the site of the North Shore Line, a railroad that went between downtown Milwaukee and downtown Chicago. The railroad went right up into the loop in Chicago. It was eliminated in 1963. So along Sixth Street and then heading into Oak Creek, you have this corridor that's just empty land.
Yeah.
And there's been kind of a hope to do something with it eventually. The county seems apparently willing to pull the plug now. Near Layton Avenue and 6th Street, there's about a 6-acre site that it's looking for what is called missing middle housing, townhomes, that type of thing, to be developed along 6th Street there. If you're looking for what business do I know in this area?
I'm going to say, I'm trying to put contact, where is this?
So 6th and Layton, but Chucho's Red Tacos is the place there, the Fiesta Hall.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You get down to Southside every once in a while, you know this stuff.
Where does the South Side start? Is it just after Walker's Point is considered South Side?
Like, where do the addresses change?
When people say South Side, when does that? Because it's South, like the South, is it before Bayview?
Oh, well before. So
it's well before Bayview, right? It's like just below, it's just south of Walker's Point, right?
Isn't it below south of 94?
The addresses change right at where Screaming Tuna is. That's where the streets go from south to north. Yeah. The edge of the Third Ward. I don't know that many people would call that north end of Walker's Point the south side, but it technically is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Again, let's see
which
what
is
we can
confusing,
figure out.
Right?
Yeah.
That Bayview is south of the south side.
Yeah, and then South Milwaukee is not in Milwaukee, but it's south.
Yes, exactly.
I always consider Bayview separate from that south side distinction.
I mean, many of my neighbors feel the same way.
I know.
But they are Southsiders.
Hey, I said for years, I'm jealous of Bayview, man. Their restaurant choices are as good as it gets. I mean, and it's a cool area, it's a funky area. And I've been spending a lot of time there lately, and I may be spending some time at the beer garden. So.
And tonight, or today actually already, bike race on Kinnickinnick Avenue, Tour of America's bike race.
Oh, is it the road?
Tour of America's Dairy Road. Yep.
Those are fun. Friday, those are very Sherwood. Fun.
After the break.
Saturday is Downer. Yep.
After the break, Jeremy takes me back to my childhood with the story about the Sheridan Park Bluffs. All right, that's next. In the city, indeed, and county, with Jeremy Gene, president and founder of UrbanMilwaukee.com, as we wrap up our hour-long local segment we do every Thursday at 11. I know this area well, grew up there, used to sleep overnight in the parks, you wouldn't do that anymore.
Are you a camper?
No, this was a bunch of young teenagers just hanging out in the parks, and your parents said, yeah, go do what you want to do. That doesn't happen anymore. Sheridan Park Bluffs are crumbling. What are they going to do about it?
Well, that is a big open question, and the consensus is they need to do something fast. Some county supervisors define fast differently than others. There is a drone photo from Milwaukee County in our article. So Steve can probably lay out the exact streets, but if you're looking for where we're talking about, right by Sheridan Park. So you have the Oak Leaf Trail there. You have a very heavily used park. You have South Sheridan Drive.
You got the pool.
The pool. I don't know how close the pool is to the bluff.
Not close.
So you have lots of moving pieces, and then you have a fast crumbling bluff that, because of different configuration things to the north, the county actually built what was called a groin field, which is a term I definitely had to look up, but is essentially an erosion control method of sticking essentially rocks or piers out into the water to blunt the water trauma on the land. To the south, immediately where that stops, you're having all kinds of erosion.
Significant. I saw the picture. It's bad.
So just to study the issue and come up with the long-term, what's going to fix this forever plan, the county is estimating $1 million. The county parks and some supervisors, like area supervisor Stephen Shea, want to do that immediately. Steve Taylor, who represents the area closer to Franklin, says, no, I want to just do this as part of the regular budget process. There's a concern that the costs will only go up if you wait to do that, that the permitting will take forever. The number that really caught my eye, this is a story reported by Graham Kilmer for Urban Milwaukee, the actual construction of the solution, $20 million.
Yeah, abatement is really expensive. Oak Creek, the city that I know very well, has done a lot of it, mainly for developmental reasons on that Lake Vista area and north. So it has to be done, because at some point it keeps coming at you. And in Cudahy, that could affect a lot of things, including roadways and potentially some housing if you go a little bit north of the park.
That is, yep, Graham has the list of all the different concerns and how they interlock. Homes are definitely among them.
Beautiful homes there, by the way.
And County Parks Deputy Director Jim Tarantino said, and the problem is that this is the only place in our whole park system where people live close to the bluff.
Yep.
So the county needs to do something here. They can't just let it erode.
No.
They have some serious concerns. Oak Leaf Trail could be closed eventually on that little segment.
Some of the most expensive homes in that community on that little stretch there.
I would believe
it. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty good property.
Lakeside view.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't equate that with Cudahy, but that area is really, really cool. You used to know a lot of people that lived in there. All right, what do we got? A quick one.
Emmy Playfield, 495 East Morgan Avenue. Once my daughter was born, we started going to that playfield as one of many. It had some George Bush graffiti on it, which I just thought was a sign of how old the playground was. Mm. It has now been completely rebuilt. It is a really, really nice playfield, Milwaukee Recreation Facility. If you're familiar with what happened at Wick Playfield, it's on that level. Really nice. Take Frankie. It's a wonderful place.
All right.
We'll do it again next Thursday. We will probably have a video next Thursday at some point. We'll shoot a video over by his Chachki shop.
Yeah, we're promising.
I got some time.
Are you promising?
I'm promising because I have time. I have unlimited time.
We're getting
Thursday.
You on a scooter?
No, I don't know about that. I'm not taking a scooter over there. We're going to walk over. It's going
to
be a nice day.
No, though, that's the whole point of the content, is to get you on a scooter.
Why?
Do it.
It's entertaining.
For who?
For the gram.
For who?
Do it for the gram, Steve.
Would you feel bad if I broke something? You would feel bad, wouldn't you?
Are you that uncoordinated?
I'm very coordinated.
Have you seen those potholes?
All right, Jeremy Janine, love what you bring to the show. Kristen, we'll do it again tomorrow with the
love what I bring to the show.
With the boys. I do love what you bring to the show. The news is next.